Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of the JRE Review. This week we have Peter Attia, Michael Schellenberger, and good old Rick Doblin of MAPS. What a legend. Joined as always by my buddy Todd.
What's happening, bud?
What is happening, Todd? How are you?
You know what? Feeling good today, buddy.
I like it.
You know, had a nice little workout. Always helps.
It's important. It's important.
And the sun's out.
It is. It's finally actually warming up a bit in freezing cold forever, infinite winter Bozeman.
Yeah.
Let's start the show.
You are listening to the Joe Rogan Experience Review Podcast. We find little nuggets, treasures, valuable pieces of gold in the Joe Rogan Experience Podcast and pass them on to you, perhaps expand a little bit. We are not associated with Joe Rogan in any way. Think of us as the Talking Dead to Joe's Walking Dead.
You're listening to the Joe Rogan Experience Review.
What a bizarre thing we've created.
Now with your host, Adam Thorne.
This might either be the worst podcast or the best one
two.
Of all time.
One, go.
Enjoy the show.
Oh, Peter. Peter. I like this guy. So he's a medical doctor. He always has a lot of good information. I didn't know that he was such a fight fan. I knew he had some training. I'm pretty sure he talked about it the last time he was on. But his knowledge of fighting and his connection to that world is runs deep. Well, I felt like they were going to do the whole podcast about boxing and fighting.
Yeah, this is one of the ones where I wish I would have heard the first time he was on, right?
Mm.
He's been on, what, a few times, or is this number two?
At least once before.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think a couple of times, actually. But, yeah.
Because they didn't talk about his book or anything, really, about what he's doing.
Not really.
And he's a freaking madman, like, kills it. Longevity,
yep.
Science, you know, behind exercise and all this stuff that you and I talk about a lot.
He's a great person to follow. His podcast has a lot of fantastic information. You know, it comes at you a little differently than Huberman's, but just as valuable, of a show. And it was interesting. He was talking to, what was it, V-Shred? About another YouTuber that has a huge following, but just basically says, like, dumb shit all the time. There is a lot of that out there. I mean, it's so hard to kind of work through the weeds of knowing who to follow and who not to. I mean, More Plates, More Dates is a great one to look at. I mean, there are some good people out there. And what I like is that they find each other in the YouTube space and give each other credibility, but the V-Shred guy has like 2 million plus subscribers. And I watched a couple of his videos, and it is so basic. It's almost like he asked ChatGPT, you know, what's like 5 motivating things I can talk about? And he's just there on this bench press looking jacked, and he's just like, yeah, make sure you got good friends around you and people hold you accountable to work out. And it's like, duh. I mean, maybe that works for people, though. Maybe that's like kind of what people want. But I don't think there's really valuable information there. I happen to agree with PT on this one.
I haven't checked him out. I think Joe was making fun of him for making fun of that V-Shred guy for just being so amateur as far as like the production. I mean, even the other dude, what's the other guy you just mentioned?
More Plates, More Dates.
Yeah, he's super, super popular.
Yeah, he's legit, though. Really legit. Does great research. Smart guy.
Well, Peter's a freaking smart guy, too. And the biggest thing I took away from this was right at the beginning when he's talking about his anger problems. Because I struggle with that and just being super self...
Critical,
right? And this negative self-talk that he's dealt with his entire life. I mean, kind of brought that up right at the beginning.
Yeah. He said he's good with drywall now because he'd punched a hole in every room in his house.
I understand that anger, dude. That rage comes out a lot. And in me, I don't punch walls anymore, but I have. But hearing him talk about how he deals with it now, and it said, you know, once he was talking to his therapist or whoever he was talking about it, he mentions how he has to train himself to realize that when he's in those zones where he gets super angry, that he has to pretend that he's talking to a buddy, that he's talking to a friend. Do you remember him saying this?
Yeah.
Like, if I'm going to yell at myself for messing up some code or whatever he's doing, or, you know, writing his book, and he freaks out and he thinks he's stupid, like, why the fuck did I say that? Or why would I think that? This is dumb. He has to almost get out of his own body and talk to himself like if he was over the shoulder of a buddy working on the same project and say, hey, man, it's okay. Why don't you try this? Why don't you do it this way? You know, because none of us would yell at our friends like that, but we're going to yell at ourselves all the time.
I get it. Yeah. That's a good way to think about it. You know, think of all the conversations that you and I have. And not that we've had many situations where we would be really angry with each other or confrontational, but we do it in our own way.
You've wanted to kick my ass a few times.
For sure. But like, I definitely would say that every day at least once, I'm meaner with myself when I speak to myself about something I did than I ever have been with you.
Right.
And that happens every day.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's like, yeah, you're kind of like pretty mean to yourself if you don't pay attention. It's happening.
Oh, dude. Absolutely.
And I'm better than I used to be. A lot of times now I'll catch myself and I'll be like, oh, you doof. Mm. Like, well done for forgetting this or putting that over there. Like, I used to be way harder. I used to just be like, you fucking idiot.
Like, I hear real you, dude. Hard. I still do it. I still catch myself doing it. And yeah.
Well, cut it out.
I think for me... For me, the best thing I can do now is with my son to not get angry with a 2.5-year-old, which is so silly to get angry at a 2.5-year-old, but all the parents out there understand it happens all the time, and I just have to remove myself from it and just try as hard as I can to sit down and try to relate to this little human, right? And I think I'm going to try this technique. I'm just pretending that I'm talking to my friend or pretending that I'm talking to my son when I actually am, right? So that was a huge, I honestly, I wish he would have talked about it more, but what did he say? He's in his 50s now, and it took him until he was 46 to realize this?
Yeah.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, it's just an important thing to talk about. You know, I think that there are people that externally might not even show much anger and aggression towards others, and this is just kind of like one of those embarrassing, shameful things that they have to carry around with them. It doesn't have to be that way. I think it's great when people talk about it and they've come to a different place in their life, you know? I often think of that when you see really big guys that have always been big. They're usually not super aggressive. I mean, you get a few, but they're just like these lovable kind of giant guys. And it's because in a way they didn't have anything to prove with their power, right? They were always big, big in school, big in college, whatever. And I think also because sometimes they're targets, at least at bars, you know, smaller guys will have complexes around them and maybe test them. So they like have to take on this type of energy and they just ultimately are like, yeah, this has happened a lot. I don't want to be fighting. I'm not going to.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. I think that there probably is a lot of truth to that. But I think in Peter's scenario, it's more, this dude's been a perfectionist his whole life. He talks about, you know, growing up in a pretty affluent suburban area where he's the only, you know, son of immigrant parents. So he kind of got made fun of his whole life. So there's always this self-deprecation in his mind of like I'm not good enough. You know, what did he say? Like even when he was in grade school, when Sugar Ray Leonard was fighting these kids, like he lost, they like brought a bunch of sugar and put it on his desk. Like, so he was getting made fun of, right?
Yeah, he was getting bullied.
And he's not a big dude.
No.
But it seems to me he has just always been a perfectionist. He says it himself, right? So he just never felt good enough.
Yeah.
And so whether he's big or small, I don't know, you know, where that comes in his brain of you know, that angst towards himself, I think, is more of his upbringing, right? And mm-hmm. wanting to do better to prove himself that way. It had nothing to do with strength.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now look what he's doing. I mean, he's crushing, right? Mm-hmm. He's got, what, 3 kids? He said, him and Joe both were really stoked about talking about their wives and how amazing their wives are, how lucky they are. I think that, you know, bringing that gratefulness into your life is so important.
Well, it's just one of those things, right? We've all been there to where our temper has betrayed us and our friendships and our relationships. It's just one of those things that if you're listening to this or you're still in a place where you struggle with your temper for whatever reason, it's definitely something that is kind of mandatory to focus on,
mm-hmm.
you know? And there are ways to do it. There are people out there that can help you, and there are resources, and there are, you know, whether it be therapy or you just read about it and learn about it, meditation, who knows? But it's definitely something you want to get a control of, because that's the point. You never know when it's just going to, you know, go off, and you got to pay some consequences for that. And I don't know, man. It can be pretty brutal. Yeah, there you go. BetterHelp, what can help you with your temper.
Todd changes, Adam changes.
Mm-hmm.
Get your change on, baby.
I love hearing those old stories of Rogan, especially when he's training, like stuff at his gyms. And he was talking about, like, I think it was like in the early 90s, he just switched over to kickboxing maybe from his national championship run of Taekwondo. Felt like kickboxing had something else to offer. You know, maybe it's kind of a slightly more aggressive fighting style. But he talked about training and or teaching with those kind of like gangster guys and being in there, fighting with them, dropping them here and there and just like hoping they won't shoot him. Like, how dangerous do you think those guys must have been?
Well, it's good for him.
Probably.
It was good for him. What did you think about the book they're talking about? I think Peter mentioned this book called Storm Before the Calm. These macro cycles that lead to transition. They happen every 30 years. There's this political and social cycle saying that both of these things are happening now in 2030. The last time it happened was during the Carter administration or right at the end of the Carter administration. I don't know much about it because I'm just, you know, I'm just going off of what Peter was talking about. But he was saying, according to this book, that the next president will be the last of the current system we have. He says the elite class will not be ruling the country anymore. Thinks we are coming to the end of a structure where people aren't following this. People will not be following the same old system after this.
Huh.
It Which does seems seem, to be a lot of turmoil, right? Like
it does seem like there is a change afoot. People are pretty freaking sick of, you know, the way a lot of things in politics are going.
Well,
and I think there's less and less trust. There's like massive divide, but I think there's getting more and more independents that are like, I don't freaking like either side here.
Right. But also we have massive protests going on in France and we're not seeing it anywhere on the news. That is a huge problem.
Dude, there's like huge protests in tons of countries.
We're not seeing it.
No. That whole thing about the...
Israel, too. Millions, yeah. Millions of people
and the
protesting.
Dutch farmers. There's some creepy shit going on over there we don't hear a lot about. They do not want to talk about protests.
No, because people are uprising, dude, and they're scared of it. It's real.
Who the... You know, this just winds me up. Like, who really is in charge of the news? It's like someone is just like, okay, we're not going to talk about that because that's going to upset people. So we're going to just create bullshit stories about things that can upset people. Well, I mean, they certainly like upsetting us.
Well, we'll get into this with Schellenberger, but just quickly, if the FBI is in on all of these tech companies that are showing us what happens on social media every day and we're getting our news from that, clearly they're a part of all the news corporations as well. I mean, there's just no doubt.
No doubt. No doubt. Let's what one thing that he did talk about, which is just like an example of good behavioral training, which is the same as his aggression thing, is when he thinks about dealing with his kids, like if his kids are being a real pain in the ass. And if anyone has kids, you know they're going to do this. And if you don't have kids, there's going to be people in your life that you care about a lot that are going to be a pain in the ass. And it's true, right? And he said that a friend of his told him, imagine being 80 years old and on your deathbed, then thinking back that this moment right now where they're annoying you is the last moment you ever get with them.
Right.
And
the last moment you get with them at that age.
Yeah. Or something, right? Maybe it's the last altogether. Then you'd really appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, man. It definitely makes a lot of sense. I think it just puts into perspective, especially when you're a parent and you realize how fast they grow. I mean, I felt like we had a kid yesterday and he's 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes by so quick. You hear it over and over and over, but until you're a parent, you don't actually understand how fast it goes.
Right.
You just don't.
Yeah.
It's like trying to tell anyone who's thinking about having a kid, and everyone freaks out, especially men. In my, you know, at least in my, you know, friend circle, the people that are wanting to have kids are freaking out. And I get it. I was right there. But it doesn't matter, because when you have them, it's just so different than what you could have ever imagined. You just deal and you just make it work.
Well, Jordan Peterson talks about that. He's like, that first 4 years is critical. It's going to be a lot of work. You're going to get very frustrated, but it goes so fast, you'll miss it,
yep.
Number one.
Yep.
And if you can just work on being as patient as possible in those first 4 years, like, so much really positive development happens, and they get to live their whole life that way.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating.
That's huge. That's huge.
So, and this brings up another fact that they talked about with women.
Yeah.
And it was like 50% of women that like get to 30 will never have kids. The other 50% will, I can't remember the
no,
next
no, no.
one.
I got it right here. It says, okay, women that hit the age of 30, 50% of them will not have kids, right? Which is a pretty damn big number. But the crazy number is that 90% of them will regret not having children.
Mm.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, women want to have kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big thing. And then they also mentioned that for men, it's very depressing for men who don't have children that are in their 60s and 70s. And I think Joe mentioned this, of just friends of his that he knows, maybe some comedian friends, and, you know, don't have any kids, don't have a wife. They're in their 60s,
yeah,
maybe even 70s. And I mean, think about how that is depressing, just thinking about that.
Yeah.
I mean, at least if you have a wife and you don't have kids, to me, these stats seem a little skewed, at least on the men's side, because I think if you have a strong relationship with your wife, having kids or not, I'm not sure. Maybe the woman regrets it. I don't know if the man regrets it.
Were saying that they do.
But that was also if you don't have a wife.
Right. Then you just have nothing. And you're just getting old on your own.
I look
probably at probably like lonely much quicker if you do life that way. It's like tons of fun, tons of freedom, but boom, you hit Lonelyville real fast.
Well, think about it, even just us in our 40s, man. I think about all the things I used to like to do. I used to love going to the bar. I still like going to see live music when I can. But going to the bar now sounds depressing as fuck. I don't want to go anywhere near a bar. I don't feel like going and just having drinks at the bar with friends. Like, I would rather... No? Not agreeing?
No, I mean, sure. I'm English, bro. I'm going to the bar.
Look, I still
love... Chill out.
What I'm getting at is the things... Once you have a child, the things that matter are so different. But if you never have kids, I don't know if you actually... I don't know if it matters, because you don't know what it's like having kids. You might regret the thought of not having children, you know what I mean? But you don't know what it's like, so it's different.
Yeah, you probably drink a lot more if you don't have kids, because you just can.
Well, you definitely go on a lot more vacations with your wife if you're still partying.
No doubt. What about 50% of Americans couldn't come up with about $2,500 for like routine medical shit? That's pretty scary. And then medical bills are like literally the first, second, and third fastest ways to bankruptcy. I mean, you don't really hear about that too much. You hear about those nightmare stories of people that just lose everything for medical bills.
Yeah.
But it's, you don't hear about it enough for probably what's happening. I bet it's happening a ton.
Well, we don't talk about it enough. We should be. I mean, and then he talks, I mean, he's from Canada, right? So Peter's talking about how, yeah, you could get, you know, in the States, you can get an MRI tomorrow and get knee surgery the next day if you have enough money or your insurance good enough or whatever. And in Canada, you can't get that, but you can go to the primary care doctor and go to the emergency room, no problem, and not have to pay anything. So mm-hmm. there needs to be some sort of middle ground here, right? Like, it's not perfect in Canada,
nope.
But it's definitely not perfect here. There needs to be somewhere in the middle where we can be like, okay, because really most people just go to the doctor for a checkup or a strep throat or a COVID test or, you know, these little things that add up, right? Like,
yeah.
you go to the doctor to get on a prescription drug or whatever. Maybe you're depressed. And a lot, I think the scariest part in my mind is people will refuse to go get help because they don't want to pay out of pocket for something that really shouldn't cost thousands of dollars, but does.
Yeah.
Right? So they just let it fester and then they get sicker and sicker. And then at the end of the day, healthcare costs are way up because nobody's taking care of themselves.
Well, even that thing he said for like routine, he would get the colonoscopy in New York with, you know, one of the top guys, ended up being about $2,000. Then he got one in Austin that finally is insurance covered. It's like $6,500. He paid $2,500 out of pocket.
Right.
And it just really does make you think. And I've heard stories about wealthy people that do have insurance, but they have like the really high deductible medical stuff and everything else they pay for themselves. And I don't know if that was like a way that they themselves can like negotiate the prices, or they just pay it because it's almost the same.
Well, because it ends up being cheaper if you pay out of pocket.
Who knows if that's always the case, but if it is, you know, I feel like that should be something people should be educated on. I don't know. It's there's a lot there. A lot to think about. Stay healthy, stay thin, work out so you don't have to go to the damn doctor all the time. Let's jump over to Michael Schellenberger. The Twitter files. Man. So Michael got a hold of those. So did Matt Taibbi. They got to go through it all. That must have been fun. People were waiting a long time for those files. And, oh, lots to talk about.
Yeah, Hunter, did you watch any of it?
The Twitter files?
Yeah. Can we watch it?
No. It's you can just like, read it. They didn't. I mean, they probably make like a, I would hope that somebody makes like a documentary or something about it. It seems like a big deal, you know? I mean, that stuff about the Hunter Biden laptop and government control and how they kind of took over. I have a clip here I want to play. It's a little scary, but it gives you an idea of kind of, I don't know, what these, you know, government folks were up to.
The Department of Homeland Security just declares election infrastructure to be part of their mission of protecting election infrastructure, and that meant protecting the media environment, protect. Put it that in quotes, you know. Yeah. It's creepy. It's patronizing. It's a power move. So that's the first thing that happens. They create something called the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency within the Department of Homeland Security to supposedly protect the media environment from foreign influence. They create something called the Foreign Influence Task Force with the FBI to basically start policing domestic speech on these platforms. They start organizing all the social media companies to participate in these meetings. So you had Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, in here, and he says to you, there's this critical moment where you ask about the Hunter Biden laptop, and he goes, well, yeah, you know, in the summer of 2020, all these FBI guys come to us saying there's going to be a hack and leak operation involving Hunter Biden, which is super suspicious because, as everybody now knows, the FBI had Hunter Biden's laptop in December 2019. What freaked me out, and I was a victim of the Hunter Biden laptop disinformation. I thought that I voted for Biden. I thought that that laptop was Russian disinformation. I just bought the whole thing. And this is from somebody who.
You're a journalist.
I'm supposedly a journalist, right? I'm a so-called journalist.
Yeah. So-called journalist. I mean, he's a legit journalist, but the way we get information, it did really come at us like, oh, this is fake, and this is how we should understand it to be true, because with social media companies and government agencies putting that out there, it turns out it wasn't. And they knew. They already had the laptop.
Yeah. This is the way I see it, man. I don't like how it's one side or the other, right? I could give a fuck less whose laptop it was. It doesn't matter. And really, in my mind, talking about the laptop over and over and over is not getting to the heart of it, which is our government has been spying on us since what? Edward Snowden told us about it in 2008?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Let's stop talking about little things. I could give a crap less about Hunter Biden's laptop. I don't care. Of course the government's hiding stuff from us. He was trying to win an election. Of course he would do that. Trump would have done it. Obviously, any political guy is going to try and hide information, just like Trump was trying to hide Stormy Daniels from saying anything. It's the same damn thing. So in my mind, why are we still talking about one side or the other, hiding this, hiding that? Everyone's hiding everything. It's a political move.
Yeah, but it's significant because, like, the FBI did it, dude.
So what? The FBI's doing that no matter what.
No, but they don't work for Biden.
Of course they don't.
They don't work for Trump either.
Right. That is the problem. So that's what we should be talking about, not the laptop. It should be more concerned about our government is spying on us. But again, we've known this since 2008. And no one's been talking about it. The only reason to me this
I
seems
think you're,
like...
you're missing a point here.
Okay, what's the
it's
point?
It's like, yeah, the NSA is spying on us.
Yeah.
The government is spying on us.
Yeah.
But this was kind of an orchestrated ploy to hide something that they knew was like just reports. Like the press were going to get a hold of it. They were going to talk about it. And it was designed to sway an election.
Yeah.
Now,
it's bullshit. I get it.
If it's the Democratic camp... or the Republican camp trying to do it, they're going to try. They do it. They have gerrymandering. They have a lot of stuff that they'd like to play with, right?
Yep.
They still have to stay within the law. Otherwise, they're going to get in trouble, you know, like Watergate. But the fact that an entire intelligence agency decided to just do it and then influence social media companies.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Right?
It's crazy.
It's like, it's not about the laptop. I don't care what's on that either, though that probably would have... persuaded if people had saw that at that time, that critical time, they would have been like, this looks nuts.
Yeah. What you're saying is the bigger question, and the only reason I talk about the laptop again is because I don't give a fuck about the laptop. I care that the FBI and the US government is funding others to keep information from us, right? They are persuading people like Zuckerberg to do a thing so that, and basically, blackmailing him and saying, hey, we're going to shut your company down if you don't do this, right? That's the problem.
Yeah, I don't know if it was that big, but they were making
Sounded like it.
They were making it seem like this is credible intelligence, and it wasn't.
Right.
It was a lie and a trick.
Right, and then the Aspen Institute doing fake cover-up scenarios to get the journalists and people on their side. I mean, that's crazy. Like, that is some major, major propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
No matter which side of the fence you're on, it doesn't matter. That is complete... It's just a complete kick in the nuts to our First Amendment.
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah. And they brought up the First Amendment a few times. I mean, look, Michael's posts are still constantly being flagged on social media.
Yeah,
it's almost like they've identified him and probably Matt as like quote unquote trouble. Like these independent journalists can't be trusted, even though we get such bullshit news. Like how many posts and videos are getting flagged from CNN? Probably none.
Well,
there's a bunch of bullshit on there.
I don't want to take sides though. This isn't about sides because. The same thing's happening on the other
CNN
side.
CNN sucks.
Whether it's CNN or Fox News, they are just doing what the people watching them want to hear, whether it's bullshit or not. They're just feeding you bullshit that people want to hear.
Right, but social media companies are not those companies. They should be flagging both CNN and Fox News often for things that
maybe they
seem
are.
Like bullshit.
Maybe
I
they
don't,
are.
I don't think they are. Not like Matt Taibbi, not like Schellenberger. You know, not like these people that have been banned from Twitter for like trying to do research.
Yeah, I don't know who's paying Matt Taibbi. I mean, I like the guy. I think he's a good journalist. I think Schellenberg is a good journalist.
Independent now, mostly.
Yeah, but you know, we don't know who's bankrolling him. I mean, other than the people that are subscribing to his Substack, I mean, he might be getting paid from fucking Fox News. I don't know.
He would say,
I don't believe that.
You don't think so? I think he could be like an undercover.
I just have a reporter. No, I don't know. And what I'm saying is, it's hard to tell these days who's paying who and whether they're independent or not. Yes, it seems to me that what's happening with the Twitter files seems to be true. But who knows what's getting hidden from the Twitter files? We're not hearing all of it. We don't know. Mm-hmm. We're just hearing what we hear from Matt Taibbi. Who's paying Matt Taibbi to talk about it? I don't fucking know. Maybe Elon's bankrolling him. I'm just saying there's a, this isn't just a right versus left or he's right, she's right. We don't know.
That's true. We really don't.
That's all I'm saying.
But but this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to figure out
right.
who we can trust.
Exactly.
And I think that somebody that would come on Rogan and talk for 3 hours and do it multiple times, you know, and have other reputable news people like Saga, you know, looking at this type of reporting, it kind of adds credibility to them. I think
totally.
Eventually heavy bias are going to be highlighted, and then you're going to get a real idea. I mean, if somebody's willing to pay these guys especially to, like, have a narrative, it's only a matter of time before that would be pretty highlighted as, like, right. why do they have this, like, strange bias?
Totally.
What did you think about after they were speaking to Congress, an IRS agent shows up at Matt's house? That yeah. sounds like some sneaky-ass pressure, dude.
Yeah, man. It's crazy what's happening, right? They are freaking out. The government is freaking out.
Yeah. Are we becoming like some sort of like Russian communist state where we'll like send over the government and, you know, members of the government to like threaten you in person?
Yeah. I mean, this Renee lady that he kept talking about with this virality project
mm-hmm.
and the, what was it? You were talking about the agent showing up at his house. It was an FBI agent. Didn't you say IRS?
I thought it was IRS.
I wrote down it was an FBI agent. And then this Renee Darietta, was that her last name? They talked about needing a new church administration, right? Which happened after Nixon was in Congress, right? They got everybody together, both sides, both parties. I don't think this will happen again because people are getting paid off left and right and everyone's too scared to tell the truth
right.
and lose their job. That's the problem, is there's just too much money involved. But having an administration that overlooks what the hell is going on, I don't care what side of the fence. That really is, to me, is the thing that needs to happen. But I just don't believe it will happen.
Yeah, there needs to be accountability for the truth.
Well, and
it should be like a truth law that only applies to politicians.
Dude.
And it's like, you gotta tell the truth. Like, regular people, me and you, we could just lie.
How are we gonna do that?
Just regular folks. I don't know. Then, you know, fact check them and then find out where they got their information and then, you know, go into their emails and be like, yeah, you clearly lied.
Well, I think it comes down to, again, it always comes down to money, and they both were talking about these scientific journals and these peer-reviewed things and studies where a lot of the times the study ends up being just what the pharmaceutical company wants you to hear, right? And so really it's funded by the government, but it's only will be funded if it comes with a particular outcome that they were looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, we just don't know what's true anymore. That's the biggest problem here. And I think I started mentioning that earlier when I was saying, I don't know who Taibbi works for. I'm not saying he works for anybody. Mm. Yeah, he's independent. We don't know who's bankrolling him.
I like what you're saying. We should be suspicious of everybody.
Everyone,
you know,
dude.
Just because someone goes on Rogan, you don't have to just be like, oh, well, they're clearly the best guy. Like, if Rogan vouches for him, like, we at least know he's not bought by anybody. So that's a good start. You know, unless it's like a pro Spotify spokesperson, I can't imagine that there's going to be much bias there. Let's move on to Elon looking for the Fauci files or the idea
now
of
we're
the
talking.
Fauci files.
Now we're talking.
Dude,
that's
so
tight.
I saw something the other day where he categorically said the NIH has never funded gain-of-function research, and then even the NIH has come out and said, yeah, we did do that.
Of course they have.
And then they went back and spoke to him again in Congress, and he's just like, no, you don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah. There's something really funky going on with that guy. I don't know why more people are not annoyed about it. I mean, the people come to his kind of defense constantly. Like, oh, he was doing his best, and he's so smart, and he's saving lives. I'm like, okay, maybe he is some of those things, but can we not look into it then? Can we not analyze everything? If he is this great guy, why can't we just check it all and see?
This comes down to exactly
supposedly
what I was
he
just
said,
saying.
He said, I don't remember or I don't know, like 200 plus times in, you know, his interview with Congress, which is like by far the most that this one lawyer that knows a lot about, you know, people that have talked in front of Congress before was like, yeah, no, it's completely unprecedented.
Well,
nobody
he's
has ever done that
he's
much.
A liar.
He's got to be.
And
he's covering his bases, and he's scared, and he's running. And why? Why? What did you do? How did you get us into a mess? Is this partially your fault? How do we not do this again? We need to know all those answers. I do.
Again, it seems like a bit of a cover-up, and that's the scary thing about taking sides, and it's what I was mentioning earlier with Taibbi. I like the guy, but I don't know what his intentions are. You know, he lost his freaking pretty damn good-paying job with Rolling Stone and then went off on his own. I don't know who's bankrolling him. I'm not saying anybody
is. Well,
he
has Substack now.
Right, which is probably doing really well for him. I think he was saying he's making like 30 grand a month off of that or mm-hmm. something, which is amazing.
That's awesome.
Good for him. That like I see that as a positive step in the right direction that we have independent journalists doing Substacks because we might get more of a truthful account of stuff. But what I'm getting at with Fauci is that you have people who believed in him, right? And they were on board with anything he said.
Because someone he was like a god of science.
And everyone was so scared, right?
Yeah.
Fear created that.
Yeah.
And now the problem is that people are not, they're not retracting from that initial stance that they took with him. It's like if things start coming out that Fauci's a total fraud, which seems to be the case in my mind, or at least you can tell he's lying about something. We don't really know what yet, but people don't want to believe that because they stand by this guy. That he was like the savior at the time, and I get that. That's how he was portrayed. And there was a lot of people who were taking vaccines and were thinking, this guy's got my back. He cares about us, and they did a really good job with that.
Here's my problem, though. It's pretty understood that nobody thinks the same all the time, and nobody thinks the same way their whole life.
I hope not.
So why do people need to lock in? Okay, so you got in arguments with a couple of your friends because you were pro-Fauci, and they were against it, and maybe they were quite condescending to you, and you felt quite threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to, like, retract your statements because of this stuff coming out, but you can't do it. Your ego is too fragile.
That is the problem.
And you're afraid, and you don't want to look like an idiot, so you just want to ignore it. Can't we just move on? That's what I hear a lot. Let's just move on. Everyone should just, let's just forget about it and be friends, and, you know, just, we got to get past this. We can't keep blaming each other. Well, it's not about that. I think it's important to find out the truth here.
Of course
it is. We can't turn our back to this. And it's okay that you were really afraid. And as this whole thing progressed, didn't start to figure out that maybe some of it's bullshit and turn your back on it, right? Well, I mean, you, since I've known you, took like a pretty 180 stance
on this.
Yeah,
I mean, I was always skeptical, but because of my family and my kid going to daycare and that, like, the vaccine was, you know, required for daycare and that sort of thing, that...
But what I'm saying is you kind of evolved with it, right? You
absolutely.
Didn't lock in stubbornly and say, I will never change my stance on this
absolutely
and I will
not.
Defend these people forever. And
I had a hard time believing the hype and believing pharmaceutical companies, but that is, you know, that's me looking at, you know, lung cancer, you know, and my grandfather having to quit smoking because, you know, because cigarettes are really bad. And when he was smoking two packs a day, everyone thought they were fine. Doctors were smoking six.
Mm-hmm.
These are the same companies that are trying to tell us it's safe. So I just wasn't that naive.
Yeah.
I wasn't against it, but I was skeptical, right? The problem that you mentioned is ego. People do not want to admit that they were wrong, dude. That's really all it is.
Yeah.
That's really at the heart of the problem, is that people cannot have an open conversation and say, yeah, I was wrong, dude. At least most people.
And here's the thing. Generally, I find that the smartest people I know are the people quickest to say, I made a mistake. What's the correct answer? And then it will build on this and then keep learning.
Yeah.
And they can keep adjusting. And they just get smarter and smarter and make better and better decisions. And I get it. It's hard to do sometimes.
And look, that's science.
But take a look at
it. Literally just... That is science. You're telling me what science is.
Yeah.
And people can't say, well, that's science. Well, science is an evolving process. It's a fucking theory.
Changes.
It's theoretical, dude. You have to test and test and test and test. Mm-hmm. And then you come up with a different answer and you're like, oh, that's science. Yeah, because it's different now. Come on, people.
Come on.
Wake up.
Let's jump over to Rick Doblin. Let's finish up with some positive science. Some positive science.
Positive science.
Now, Rick is a legend. He is a pioneer.
The Doblin Goblin.
He is doing phenomenal work. I have friends that are therapists, licensed behavioral health therapists, that want to go into the MAPS program so that they can facilitate psilocybin therapy, MDMA, possibly ketamine. I think that's primarily with an MD, though. I think medical doctors need to be at all of these.
Mm.
But then you get therapists or psychologists that can work through the experience. Just so much positive data. And the fact that he's been doing it so long with all the pushback and is now getting so much support, it warms my heart. Like, towards the end of the pod, they were talking about how really this is one of the most bipartisan things that is going through the government right now. The FDA are getting on board with a lot of it.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, he talks about Ted Nugent's son, and Ted Nugent was very anti-drug and very anti-psychedelic treatment, and his son wants to be a psychedelic therapist.
Yeah.
That'll change a dad real quick. And that's the thing, is there's people in Congress, whether they have, you know, someone who's struggling with depression or suicidal or whatever, or came back from the war. I think the key is the war thing, right? The PTSD and the results that they're seeing with MDMA in particular.
Yeah.
About people coming home from wars and being suicidal. What a shame that is, right? And they don't know what to do. And this, the data is insane. How, you know, one or two trips on MDMA, you know, in this with the set and the setting and the music and the therapy that they're doing, the results are profound.
I don't think you need to talk to a family member that's struggling really badly with PTSD for very long to hear the pain that they're in if they're, you know, capable of opening up to you at all, or you're just seeing their actions and behaviors because they're struggling so hard to function, to say to yourself, whatever it takes.
Yeah, especially if you're the parent of that child.
100%.
I mean, and that's where the bridge comes in, and he talks about this finding common ground, be the bridge, right? That's the MAPS motto, be the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Moving forward, be the bridge. And it was funny how he talks about this civil disobedience when he was younger. You know, he never signed up for the draft. He kind of dodged it. He didn't put his papers in. He was scared. He talks to his parents about it. His dad was like, well, you're never going to be able to become a lawyer. He goes, okay, well, that's fine. I guess I'll become a psychedelic therapist.
Yeah, I'll do something else then. All right.
And now look, I mean, it's just such a cool story.
Yeah.
And man, it's hopeful, right? It's very hopeful right now. Like you said, it's one of the things that seems to be something that Congress may be able to agree on,
mm-hmm.
at least for veterans and people struggling who are coming back from war. If we can start there, right? Let's start there, which seems to be the case with MDMA anyway.
Well,
and
but
then
it's
mushrooms
also,
are next. And
it's also a great example of, you know, to have at least one thing that potentially changes society, and it's been something that's very illegal, you know, that both parties agree this is worth looking at. We should work together on this. There's almost no pushback. You can take that kind of cooperation to other elements of things that we're trying to pass that we fight on all the time and be like, hey, how about we approach it in a similar way? How about we just look at data instead of just the politics? They're not going to be able to do it with everything, but it's nice that we still have some things because it seems like they disagree on so much. But the irony of the thing that kind of, in a way, brings government together, brings the parties together, is MDMA and psilocybin. I mean, it's beautifully ironic because that's what those two drugs would do if you gave them to both parties.
Of course, dude. Yeah. Everyone just needs to take
some
MDMA together.
We just spray all of Congress.
We will find common ground real fast.
And then they're just rubbing each other's shoulders and somebody puts on some techno music and... Yeah. They're just having a good time.
Just need some water, you know?
Yeah, you gotta stay hydrated.
Give me some water.
Joe talks about his 5-MeO experience, which he's done a few times here and there. That's something that I once tried. Bear in mind to separate the two dimethyltryptamines. NN dimethyltryptamine is the fractal one, where you see the entities and the creatures and maybe aliens and
elves.
The elves, yeah, the machine elves.
Don't forget the elves.
Terrence McKenna would describe. But then 5-MeO is the one that comes from a toad, right? And it's much, much different.
No visuals.
It's very disassociative. You don't really know where you're at. And I've always felt like Joe's descriptions of this were very good. They're so much clearer than I can. Like, it makes sense to me when he's saying it. I'm like, that's exactly what it is. But I've always struggled to articulate it. And he's really good at this. And it's like he said one thing where he's like, yeah, I thought I'd really fucked up because I thought that maybe I'd died. And that's kind of a thought that exists in there. Now, there are some like euphoric, loving, happy bits, but it's a very heavy experience. And it's the kind of thing that you think about for a long time afterwards. And it's one of the few experiences, at least in the psychedelic realm, that Joe is talked about like not really wanting to go into again. And I was sure of that after I did my first one. I was like, wow, that was amazing. I don't know if I need to do that again. It's a lot.
But Ibogaine, he has not done Ibogaine yet.
No, he hasn't. I don't know a lot about Ibogaine. I thought it was brilliant to bring up Aubrey Marcus's dad again, who we talked about not that long ago being the creator of the Fleshlight, which I did not know. But now also, he was one of the first guys that pushed Ibogaine therapy. It's like, what an incredible family. Like, really.
What was your take on when Doblin chatted about the worst part of certain drugs is the relationship we have with them, right? Whether they're not good or bad, but he mentioned Dr. Carl Hart, this drug policy reformer.
I think he's like a Brown or a Princeton professor.
Yeah, and it caught my attention to talk about how certain drugs aren't good or bad, right? They're just it depends on your experience with them and your relationship we have with them, right? Like some people. He talked about Jamie. He could take fucking, what did he say, like 2,000 milligrams
Like THC. 1,300. And he's still talking with people
Most
at a party.
People would not be able to function for days.
I'd be high for a month.
Right? Yeah.
I'd be scared to death for the first 3 weeks.
I'm scared to take more than 2 milligrams of THC at a time. It just makes me weird. It gives me paranoia. Hate it. But I think that's what he was getting at, is that certain drugs, they're not good or bad. It depends on your relationship with them. It depends on, you know, getting the purest drugs you can, which is obviously a huge problem with all this fentanyl poisoning that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And
gotta be careful.
This punish. You know, we're setting examples by punishing people. We know that this is not working, guys. That punishing people for doing drugs is the stupidest thing ever. Unless you're going to give them therapy for it. Clearly these people have a problem, whether it's with heroin or whatever. It doesn't matter what drug. And again, it depends on the person. And so making an example out of people by putting them in jail is so silly, and it needs to stop. And, you know, you've got these bullshit stories on Oprah from 2001, which you and I both know was the rave days, and everyone was doing E.
Yep.
Super fun, but I remember them talking about these holes in the brain, right?
Yeah, it sounds like bullshit. Dude, I thought it was bullshit then. They did a Time magazine piece on that.
It scared me.
Yep. They said that your, like, neurons, in your brain break down, and then they rebuild, but they look different. Yet you seem to function the same. We just don't know the long-term effects.
Right.
And it was even then. I'm like, wait a second. How are we studying this?
But
how much research have we put into this?
How crazy was that they canceled the second show that Doblin was supposed to be on?
Mm-hmm.
The benefits of MDMA, they canceled the show.
Yeah, pussies.
And the woman that they had invited onto the show to do the brain scan, who had taken a bunch of ecstasy or MDMA at the time and was partying and raving, whatever, did a separate brain scan, right? That was what Doblin, I think, had mentioned for her to do, like get a brain scan from some other doctor because they're gonna tweak the results.
Mm-hmm.
And she did, and then shows it to Oprah, whoever the producers or whatever, and they don't show the show. I mean, it's just typical. It's like what we're talking about with Schellenberger and other things. It's going to get skewed. It's Hollywood, dude.
Yeah.
They're gonna put out what sells.
It's so dumb.
But it seems like we're getting through that stage, right? We're getting through that stage of the bullshit. People know that it's bullshit.
Well, you know, Oprah probably then would have got a huge amount of backlash from parents that are dealing with their kids that are like raving or whatever. And it's like, oh, now Oprah wants to be pro this drug that's like potentially ruining our kids' lives because everything's perception.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of kids were doing it and going to raves and partying. So it's, you know, parents are making assumptions.
Well, and they realized that the monkeys were getting fed methamphetamine.
Oh yeah, that whole study was a mess.
Right. And the was that in this one or was last week?
It was a few weeks ago, but that was the original study with MDMA, that they had this negative result in the brain.
He talks about it on here, though, too.
Oh, he
about
did?
How, yeah, it was in Johns Hopkins. The primates were dying from MDMA because the dose was so high. Or, sorry, not MDMA. They thought it was MDMA, but it was actually methamphetamine.
How do you make that mistake?
But the doses are so different, right? Like, it's a small amount of MDMA that you need to get high, right?
Yeah, well, you don't need a lot of meth either.
Right.
If it's pure meth, that'll wreck you fast.
The amount of meth that they were feeding these primates was way higher than it should have been, and it was meth, not MDMA.
See, that to me doesn't sound like a mistake.
Right.
That to me sounds like somebody poisoned a bunch of monkeys and then went, there you go. Nuts, dude.
Or
absolutely
that, how
nuts.
About the AA founder? They talked about him for a minute, and I had heard this in the past about how
he did LSD.
The founder of AA, that was his mystical experience that he had that made him
mm-hmm.
realize, hey, I can, you know, get off of being a booze hound. Mm-hmm. I can stop drinking, and I think it was because of that LSD trip that he had.
Yeah, well, that, you know, they said that it helps with cluster headaches. What was it, bromine?
Yeah,
LSD,
it was a different form
of
LSD.
Yeah, non-psychedelic.
Yeah.
You can give them much higher dosages because you're not tripping.
Not
and
fun either.
Really good for getting rid of these cluster headaches that often, you know, well, not often, but could sometimes lead to suicide because they're so brutal. You know, is a cluster headache worse than a migraine then? It sounds like
it. Yeah, it said it was way worse, yeah.
Poor.
Yeah. Completely debilitating. I mean, migraines alone.
Oh, so bad. Yeah, you can't do anything. It shuts you down. Anyway, he talked about psychedelicscience.org. Go there. Use code ROGAN20, 20% off. We'll put a link in the bio. And this is one of these, like, you know, psychedelic conferences. And let's blow it out of the water this year. Get in there, folks.
It's
go
great.
To it.
It's amazing.
Learn a lot. I'd
amazing
like to go.
Science.
I think I might go.
Let's go.
Yeah, we should. We should go. Let's learn some things. Let's do a pod on it. I like it. The last bit I wanted to talk about psilocybin and doses. So he's talking about the effects of it. You know, microdosing, fun. Don't get me wrong. Probably good for like working through some thoughts and definitely some anxiety if you do a gram a day.
Yeah.
You know, kind of takes the edge off. Joe did it when he was going through the cancel stuff.
It helps with anxiety for sure.
If you want to see some real results, then they're talking about higher dosage. You got to kind of push through. He gave the example of the plane. You got to go real high, get past the turbulence, and then, you know, you kind of break through, and then you can do some real work on yourself. That should be guided. I was just going to say that.
This is not taking an eighth of shrooms and going in partying with your boys.
No. This you want a professional there.
Going in with an intention, having the eye mask, having the music, you know, writing things down. I'm ready, dude. I need it.
It sounds
3.5 grams
and
or
then
more.
Also, it looks like they've raised enough money, over $100 million, for the MDMA research. The FDA is looking at all the ways that they've done it. There's very little toxicity, you know, very few side effects. You know, you get a bit sweaty, but of course you do. You're having a great time. Like, yeah, you're going to get hot. What are you going to ban going to the gym because you got sweaty? Like, but they're doing the research well. The studies are good. And, you know, the FDA, you got to think with a lot of medication that gets passed, when it comes to some drug that was banned and it has a stigma because of it's a party drug, for it to then become legal through the FDA, they're going to be pretty strict about it. So it has to have kind of overwhelmingly beneficial effects. And I love that it's able to create that and it's safe. And we're getting real close. That might be a fantastic way for people to work through real serious traumas that, if you think about it, therapy and psychology is not that old of a science, right? We've been doing math for thousands of years. I mean, this is how they built the pyramids. But I mean, Freud was really the start of thinking about the internal brain.
That's not true.
Who did it before that?
Plato, dude.
I mean, philosophers, kinda.
Come on.
It's not the same. That wasn't really like a science. They weren't.
Agree to disagree, but you're right. It's not an old science. You're definitely right on that.
Right. I mean, look, philosophers, you could say that.
Plato knew that you had to get out in nature and maybe they didn't know what it was called yet or it wasn't called psychology yet, but they were thinking about the mind and the heart and the way that reacts with, you know, your personal.
I mean, I guess you're right. You could say that like every conversation between a couple of guys around a campfire while they're making sense of their own existence.
They're just trying to make sense.
Therapy.
Yeah.
But like putting it into something that we use in the West.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, a paper that builds on another one where they're doing like using the scientific process, for example. I mean, it's fairly new. Right.
Oh, it's definitely new. It's definitely new. And
and there's only so many answers we have, right? There's only so far we've got. There's certain people that have traumas that are kind of hard to identify, to get them to speak up, to get that energy out of them.
Well, that's
there are
thing.
Some people that go to therapy their whole lives and they're stuck with certain things.
Well, MDMA gets rid of that wall, that barrier.
It might do. And that's what I'm excited about. It might be that thing that can get you just kind of over the edge. And
it opens up your mind to talk about things that you're scared to talk about without it.
I'm very excited for it, though. I'm very excited. Well, there we go.
Love it. Thank you,
Todd, for this week. And thank everybody listening. We appreciate you guys. As always, stay tuned. Next week we have a regular pod. The week after that, though, we will be in Austin. We are going to visit Rogan's new show.
The Mothership.
We're going to do a show from Austin, which is going to be exciting. So we're going to give you a real breakdown of that town. I can't wait to get that. I'm very excited. It's going to be great.
Love it.
Later, guys.
Thanks for tuning in.